This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, American politics may feel like it's divided past the point of fixing, but a political philosopher tells us that there are concrete steps we can take to make things better. Now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has released two new reports this month detailing mortality rates for mothers and newborns in the United States. New moms are dying at a higher rate than in any other industrialized nation, and it's only gotten worse during the pandemic. Maternal deaths nearly doubled over the course of 3 years, with more than 1,200 new moms dying in 2021. The racial disparities are big. Deaths of new black moms were two times the national average in 2021, and in 2020, the rate of unexpected deaths of black babies spiked almost three times the rate of white babies. What do we need to do to protect the lives of pregnant women and infants and tackle these disparities? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story to share about a difficult pregnancy in your own life? If you work in pre and or postnatal care, what kind of things have you seen? What do you think we could do better for moms and their babies? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tiffany Green is an associate professor in the Departments of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Tiffany, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Nice to be here with you again.
I'm feeling like a broken record here, but it seems like there are a lot of problems where they existed before the pandemic. The pandemic made them worse. Can you talk about the sort of problem we had, especially with maternal health, before the pandemic and the disparities we had then, before we hit the impact of COVID?
Well, I guess one thing that I would really like to let your listeners know about is that this is not a new problem. There was a report in 1917 talking about the crisis in maternal mortality. And the racial disparities in and pregnancy-related mortality. So unfortunately, this problem is nothing new. But as you might imagine, a global pandemic likely made it even worse.
What are some of the things underlying those problems even before a global pandemic?
I think a lot of people think about pregnancy related deaths as just happening in a hospital, but a lot of the deaths. Hold on, I have a little visitor back here.
Oh, okay, special guest star.
Yes, a guest star. A lot of the deaths were also occurring. Hold on, one moment.
Sure. Talking to Tiffany Green about maternal health in the United States. I'll remind you, while we get that sorted, you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you have an experience or a question to share. Tiffany, do we have you back?
You do have me back. So what I was going to say was that a lot of what we see in terms of deaths are also happening because of the social determinants of health. You know, people, it's where people live, it's where people work, it's where people play, and not having the resources to have as healthy a pregnancy as possible. So it's not just access to medical care necessarily, it is also access to the social safety net.
Right. It might seem like there might be easy fixes, you know, more doctor's appointments before and after childbirth and things like that. How do we start to tackle those longer term concerns that might lead up to some of these problems?
So one is making sure that people arrive in pregnancy healthier, right? And so I think, and I hate to use the word health because it can be a little bit ableist, but what I mean by that is making sure that people, when they start a pregnancy, they have control over chronic health conditions like diabetes, like high blood pressure. They can exacerbate the effects of pregnancy on the body itself.
Now, turning to prenatal care, what kind of access to prenatal care could we use that might help with this as well? Not just the long-term things, but during the pregnancy now.
Sure. Access to prenatal care is pretty important, as you might imagine. And I want to say that, you know, I'm speaking with my researcher's hat on. We know that the access to prenatal care is likely much more important for the birthing or pregnant person than moms, right? Or than babies, I should say. And this is a chance to make sure that that doctors are able to assess or address any or nurse midwives are able to assess any conditions that might lead to an unsafe pregnancy, like preeclampsia, like high blood pressure, like diabetes, and make sure those are managed as much as possible. And so you didn't ask specifically about the pandemic in this mm-hmm. case, but the pandemic made it more difficult for people to access care. Thankfully, that there are things like telehealth that opened up, but it also meant that people that were getting, people didn't necessarily get the same kind of prenatal care that they needed. And that possibly could have led to some exacerbations of deaths.
Let's talk a little more about the impact of COVID now, because it clearly made a bad situation even worse. What kind of things do we see over the course of COVID? You just mentioned, it was harder to get to that appointment that might have helped. COVID itself, before there were vaccines and after vaccines for unvaccinated moms going through childbirth, how big a factor was that?
You know, it's hard to fully say. So one is that COVID really isn't listed, and that gets people really, really confused, because COVID is often not listed as the primary cause of death for people that die during pregnancy or during the postpartum period. What we can say is that there was an increase in deaths, and importantly, that COVID was a secondary cause of death. So the way that researchers try to parse this is say, okay, we're seeing these increases in death. Is COVID playing a factor? And indeed, there is some preliminary evidence that COVID was at least an underlying factor in these deaths that we're seeing.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Luna is with us in Madison. Luna, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Luna?
I just wanted to share that for my own experience, having a doula was such a powerful and impactful experience to have that support in the hospital. And I've seen some research that has shown that having a doula who can be your advocate for you in the hospital, but also help with that prenatal care, has had a lot of positive impacts on maternal mortality rates. And so that was just a really positive experience for me. And I think on a systemic or policy level, if doulas were more affordable, if they were just seen as a part of care that a woman receives, I think we could really see some changes made.
Luna, thanks a lot for the call. Tiffany, the role of doulas, the opportunity to expand the services they provide.
So, I want to, just to level set a little bit, I am a big fan of doulas. I think they play such an important role. And unfortunately, during the beginning of the pandemic in particular, a lot of people were not allowed to have the support people they needed in the room for fear of infection. And that was a problem, because some pregnant people weren't getting the support they needed during labor and delivery. Do I think that doulas are an important player in the system? Yes. Do I think they are responsible for addressing systemic failures, right, in the systems we have? No. And I can tell you that just from some of my conversations with doulas, many of them are, they're doing the work, but they're tired, right? And so I just want, and that's not what your caller was saying, but I really want to get past the idea that doulas are sort of a low cost intervention to dealing with systemic problems, dealing with the fact that pregnant people don't always get the care that they need, right? And so I think that we know that doulas are beneficial for the patient experience. Do we have data that they are actually reducing maternal mortality? That's not data that I have seen up until this point.
Luna, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Tiffany, I've seen a lot of concerns that when Black women report to healthcare providers problems during pregnancy or after childbirth, they may not get the same response as their white peers. They may not get treatment. And that's part of the problem we're talking about. Is that something you've seen?
Rob, this is a complicated question. Mm-hmm. So do we know that Black birthing people and pregnant people are reporting experiences of not being listened to during care? We do have some data. One of my students, Fiona Weeks, has been working on some data using PRAM, so the Pregnancy Risk Assessment and Monitoring System data from Wisconsin, including a full sample of Native American and Indigenous births. And she indeed finds that Native American birthing people in particular are more likely to report not being heard or listened to during pregnancy, as well as Black birthing people. But the effect or association was actually strongest among Indigenous birthing people.
Talking to Tiffany Green, associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest CDC numbers. They go up to 2021, showing a jump in the mortality rate of new moms during pregnancy, shortly after childbirth, and a spike in racial disparities for them and for newborns. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a COVID-era pregnancy story you'd be willing to share? What do you see as the causes for these disparities in these death rates? What kind of changes do you want to see? What questions do you have for our guest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Tiffany Green, associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest data from the CDC that shows a dramatic increase in maternal mortality and a jump in Black infant mortality rates during the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, solutions, your questions, your experiences. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Tiffany, let's jump now to this disparity in mortality rates among newborns. Again, a racial disparity. I'm guessing some of those same social factors we've been talking about are part of the story here. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, so there has been some data that suggests that, I'm assuming you're referring to the studies that shows that there's a jump in deaths from SIDS among Black Black infants. Yeah, so that study did come out, and it suggested that SIDS rates spiked during even a little bit before, but definitely during the pandemic. Absolutely. So the authors kind of speculate about a few things, including differences in breastfeeding rates and cultural attitudes towards breastfeeding. And I've been pretty clear that the data aren't there to be able to speculate in those ways. I do think that, again, I feel like I'm a broken record, but getting back to providing families with the social supports that they need to have not just healthy pregnancies, but raise their children in safety. So making sure that people have time off of work, making sure that people have homes that allow them to raise their children in safety. Improving our social safety net programs, all of those things matter when it comes to having healthy pregnancies. And although I have not talked as much about structural racism today, and a lot of people think that's sort of a nebulous concept, what it means is that the way that our society is patterned and structured disadvantages some groups, including and especially Black people in America. And so I think it's really important to contextualize that and really share with your readers that we have pretty copious evidence that segregation and other forms of structural racism are very tightly linked to racial differences in infant mortality, racial differences in preterm birth, low birth weight. Segregation matters for all of those things. And my team has done some of this work, and lots of other scholars have done this work as well. So I wanna really emphasize the importance of that in terms of trying to understand these disparities and hopefully change them instead of talking about them from year to year.
Yeah, how do we do that? I mean, it's easy to say, let's have an extra well child visit or access to medication or whatever, like one-off things. What kind of interventions do you think we could realistically see that tackle these wider problems that are literally centuries in the making?
You want to know my opinion? I guess you asked me. So, you know, I think, like, you're right. Like, these extra well child visits, although they're important, you know, they're great, they're not addressing systemic inequality. So I'm actually more interested in what happens when we actually give people money. We know that a lot of the income transfer programs that we're seeing seem to improve health and well-being among the groups they're working with, right? So I think that they could be a really, there's a program in Oakland that's giving money to Asian and Pacific Islander and Black pregnant people. And I'm really excited to see what the results of their study are going to be, because they're just giving, they're giving funds to people in need and seeing what happens.
There's kind of a mindset change here, Tiffany. I think a lot of us in the United States think of health as an individual thing. I try to, you know, have good nutrition or exercise or whatever, and I go to the doctor to solve this problem with me. This way of thinking of health as a social issue, I hear a lot of experts talk about it. Do you see it getting into the public eye, into policymakers' minds as well? Do we still have you there, Tiffany? I don't think so.
I'm here.
Oh, there you go.
Yes, yep. I'm here. I'm here.
I don't know if you caught the question. The idea of health
yes,
as an individual.
Yes, I
okay,
did. And I think it's a great one. So what do I see? What do I see happening? One is that there's a set of bills that we have not passed. Congress has not really passed. And it's called the Black Maternal Momnibus. Hold on one moment. It's called the Black Maternal Momnibus. And those bills actually address many of the social determinants of health.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Tiffany Green, associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. She joined us today to talk about an increase in maternal mortality rates, plus racial disparities among moms and among newborns during the pandemic. Well, you could still share your stories if you'd like. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Former state Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly is promising voters he won't be driven by politics if they return him to the bench. But the forces of Republican politics are swirling around Kelly like a storm. Kelly has shied away from talking directly about issues that might come before the court. In a two-part series about the candidates for Wisconsin State Supreme Court seat, Sean Johnson reports Kelly's supporters are taking a decidedly different approach.
In mid-March, longtime conservative activist Bob Donnell organized what he called a conservative St. Pat's party. He holds it at Clifford's Supper Club in Hales Corners, a village in southwest Milwaukee County. Strings of white lights hang from the ceiling, and at one end of a long banquet hall, a band plays. Donnell wears a National Rifle Association hat and a shirt decked with green clovers as he talks to friends at a table near the bar. He calls events like these educational rallies.
Or get out to vote things. That's what I do, is work like hell to get out the votes.
Orville Seamer, another longtime activist, says getting the votes out in this election might be more important than ever. He says Kelly's opponent, Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz, doesn't just hold a different judicial philosophy. He thinks she's a threat to more than a decade of conservative accomplishments.
Well, I think you look back, you know, all the Walker reforms, Act 10 and redistricting and, you know, the Dobbs decision at the U.S. Supreme Court, all those things, they don't appear on the ballot, but they really are on the ballot. People are voting on those issues.
The speakers at this event make a similar case. They include Republican lawmakers and former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson.
Everything that we believe in as conservatives is going to be up for grabs. That's how important this election is.
When it's Dan Kelly's turn to speak, he sidesteps all of these issues. He focuses on Protasiewicz. She shared her personal beliefs in this campaign, including her support for abortion rights. Kelly says Protasiewicz crossed a line for a judge.
This is an election like no other, and mostly because my opponent is a candidate like no other.
Kelly was an attorney in private practice until he was appointed to the court by former Republican Governor Scott Walker in 2016. He lost his first Supreme Court election in 2020. During a forum at the Milwaukee Press Club earlier this month, he said politics has no place in the courts, where the job of a judge is to apply the law.
I am running to be the most boring Supreme Court justice in the history of the country. The role of the court is not to be original, is not to be innovative.
But Kelly has a history with Republicans. More than a decade ago, he defended the state's Republican-drawn legislative maps. Just last year, his clients included the state Republican Party and the Republican National Committee. Howard Schwaber teaches political science and law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says Kelly's resume frees him up to run a more traditional judicial campaign.
He has all of that background that, without him having to say anything, tells those interests that he is their guy.
And those interests have taken notice and paid for the overwhelming majority of his political ads. They include Fair Courts America, a group funded by GOP megadonor Richard Uihlein, and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Both have attacked Protasiewicz for being soft on crime, a staple of Republican campaigns. Democrats outspent those groups in the opening months of this campaign, but a recent tally showed conservatives closing the gap. Donnell, the longtime activist, says Kelly started out behind in this race, but thinks he has momentum.
I said 2 weeks ago, if I walked into Target and talked to 100 people, 95 of them would say, "What election?" Now they're starting to pay attention.
If Kelly loses, liberals would flip Wisconsin Supreme Court for the first time in 15 years. If he wins, conservatives would likely keep their majority until at least 2026. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
We'll hear Sean's coverage of the other candidate, Judge Janet Protasiewicz, later in the show. And you can follow all of our reporting and other coverage of this state Supreme Court race over at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, communities around the country are changing their zoning laws, aiming to open up more housing units. We'll hear from two housing experts about one kind of development called accessory housing units. That's tomorrow morning at 8. Then this will be fun. Find out why pinball is making a comeback and get a preview of a major convention in Wisconsin that's going to feature not just pinball, but arcade games and more. Now, they're going to love to hear from you. Are you a longtime pinball fan or arcade game fan yourself? Have you tried it lately, or is it something in the distant reaches of your memory? You can get started right now on that conversation. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Now, I loved pinball when I was a kid. Now, my uncle had this store where he sold swimming pools and pool tables and, yes, pinball machines. So I loved hanging out there and playing pinball. I remember the Evel Knievel machine. My secret of pinball was I was terrible, and I still am. And people nudge the machine. I can't do it without tilting, but maybe you're better. Email your pinball story, ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's no secret that there are big divisions in American politics these days, and it can feel like things are getting worse over time. Our next guest says there's been a great pulling apart over the last few decades, and that's a worrisome sign for the future of representative democracy. But she says there's good news. There are concrete steps we can take to make things function better by renovating our political system and our attitudes to reflect new realities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see driving the divisions in American politics? Do you feel like our system of representative government doesn't always represent us that well? What changes would you like to see? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Danielle Allen is a political theorist and the James Bryan Conant University Professor at Harvard University and founder and president of Partners in Democracy. She has a regular column in the Washington Post. Danielle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Glad to be with you.
In one of your pieces on The Great Pulling Apart, you share a family story that I think influenced some of your thinking about American politics and really illustrates what it could be about your father and your aunt, each of whom ran for office from a very different perspective. Can you share that story with us?
Sure, that's right. Now, I was fortunate to grow up in Southern California in a big extended family, lots of aunts and uncles and cousins, and we were a family. We are just people who have always loved and fought for democracy. So civic engagement was in the air and water. That said, people were engaged across the whole political spectrum. So there was one year in my youth, an amazing year, when my aunt was on the ballot in the Bay Area, Northern California, for Congress for the Peace and Freedom Party, which is pretty far left on the political spectrum. And the very same year, my dad was running for Senate, for U.S. Senate from Southern California as a Reagan Republican. So we had the most incredible family dinner table conversations. I mean, they would just go at it, really, you know, and he was like this skinny guy, very professorial, always smoking a pipe and smoke curling around his head. And my aunt was a really big woman, sort of built like a Mack truck. She was gay. She had a big belly laugh. And they really disagreed on the how of what policy should be. But as a kid watching them, it was always very clear to me that they agreed. They really came together in their view of what they were after. They were both seeking empowerment for themselves, for their families, for their communities. So, you know, huge debates about how market liberties versus public sector investment, civic virtues versus experiments in living, but this just shared sense of purpose. And it was always also clear that they would just have each other's back come what may. So that was really where I learned what democracy should be, that we can have this shared purpose, this project of empowerment broadly for all of us, but then, you know, really go at it in terms of what the policy should be for getting there, but also at the same time, like, never break the bonds of love, always hold sacred the human dignity of the person in front of us.
And you've written then about this great pulling apart, where we continue to disagree about the policies and the means, but maybe are losing those core shared values. What have you seen happening?
That's right. So, I mean, it's a funny feature of those of us who are in our early 50s that our lifetimes have coincided with the rise in the country of a whole bunch of, you know, splitting up phenomena. So rise of income inequality and wealth inequality, rise of mass incarceration, also the rise of polarization, as you've named it. And so we have this incredible separating out of experience. In my own family, here I sit as a tenured faculty member at a private university, which is an incredibly privileged position to be in. At the same time, I have cousins who are dead.
You cut out there for a moment, Danielle. You're saying you had cousins?
Exactly. I'm saying at the same time that here I sit in this incredibly sort of comfortable existence, I've lost cousins. So younger cousins who we've lost to substance use disorder, to homicide, for example. These are terrible and tragic things and not things I can feel at peace about. And that sort of real divergence of experience is, in some sense, you know, what the whole country has experienced. And then you throw into the middle of that misinformation and all the sort of problems of the toxicity of social media. And we start to struggle with finding solutions paths for really, really significant problems. And then we start fighting each other along the way as we get sort of stuck without solution pathways.
Before we turn to solutions, you have a couple interesting structural things you point out as problems. One, we have this system in the United States designed for a population in the 1790 census, just after the Constitution was signed, under 4 million people. Now, Wisconsin alone has almost 6 million, U.S. 330
right.
million. It's not surprising in some ways we might buckle under that strain. Why is that?
Exactly. I like to talk about our democracy as a house that we all share. It is literally designed, it is architected, it is built. The Constitution built it, but so did a whole host of other laws and the like. And the truth of the matter is that this house that we all share needs renovation. You know, it's not yet fit for purpose to deal with the sort of level of scale and complexity that we have in the 21st century. There's also the just very basic fact that this house we share wasn't originally built for everyone. So some folks got light-filled rooms and others got relegated to dark, dank basements and so forth. So I think we have a job to do to renovate our institutions, renovate our democracy so that it's fit for purpose in the 21st century, can meet our needs, and where there are really good rooms for everybody.
And then you mentioned social media a couple minutes ago, and I think, you know, people could think really easy of examples of why social media might be bad for politics. But you go back to some of the earliest writings about how our system should work, and you see the way we communicate on social media violating, in some ways, some of those early principles. Could you talk that through for us?
Well, exactly. It's this interesting fact that when the founding fathers, when the founders were designing the Constitution, they had a lot of really clear ideas about how to solve the problem of faction. They were really focused on trying to solve that. And now you could say that with our depth of polarization, like, we're in exactly the place they were trying to avoid. When they sought to solve that problem, that was really the goal of designing systems of representation, right? They were worried about the ancient examples of democracy where all the citizens gathered in the assembly and made choices together. And so instead they wanted representative democracy where we would elect people to go to Washington or at the time go to Philadelphia on our behalf to make those decisions. And in designing this, you know, Madison articulated the reasons for it in an essay called one of the Federalist Papers, Advocating for the Constitution, James Madison. And he said there are sort of two reasons that this principle of representation should work to address the problem of faction. One, because the representatives would be people, they would be selected to do the job of sort of filtering and synthesizing and bringing some sort of sense and sensibility to the broad range of opinions in the country. But then the other thing that was supposed to make this work was just the basic fact of the breadth of the country, the literal geographic spread, the dispersal of the people. The idea was that people with extreme views would have trouble finding each other, and that would mean they would have to go through representatives to get their views into the public sphere. And then the representatives could do that filtering and synthesizing and sort of cleaning up and moderating job. Now, obviously, that's what social media has just sort of blasted out from under us. It is no longer the case that people have to go through representatives in order to get their views into the public sphere. And we now live in a world where people with extreme views can coordinate very, very easily. So what that means is that one of the premises of the actual original design of the Constitution just no longer holds. So we can't depend on geography to be a part of our solution to the problem of faction. So in the absence of that, we actually have work to do to rethink how our very representative institutions are organized so that we can deal with the problem of faction and the problem of polarization.
Political philosopher Danielle Allen is with us from Harvard University, looking at divides in American politics and how to overcome them. We've heard about some of the problems, some of the causes she sees coming up, some possible solutions. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Some of the solutions she has on the table in her ongoing series at the Washington Post: boosting our civic engagement, making the House of Representatives bigger, finding better ways to talk, to communicate, to represent us. What do you think? What's your solution to our divisive politics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Harvard University political philosopher Danielle Allen. She says there's been a great pulling apart in American society and politics, but she says it's possible to bring Americans together again with some changes to our political system and the way we engage with it. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Danielle, one solution you've offered in your last couple of pieces, and this is something coincidentally we talked about on this show a month or two ago, making the House of Representatives bigger. How do you see that helping solve some of the crises we've been talking about?
Oh, thank you, Rob. I'm so glad to know that you've already been talking about this. That's fantastic. Yes, I think it is time for us to uncap the House of Representatives. It has been stuck at 435 for 100 years, just about, since 1929. And however, the House was always supposed to grow. And why was it supposed to grow? The point of the House of Representatives, of course, is to make the voice of the people heard in government, and representatives were supposed to be close to their constituents and to be able to be responsive to them. We're at a point now where any given rep represents about 760,000 people or so, and we will probably get close to a million by the middle of this century. So that makes it much harder for any representative to know their constituents. It makes it much harder for them to just do the work involved with constituent services. It makes it harder for voters to hold their representatives accountable. So the piece of the system that was supposed to be most about the proximity of representatives to people has gotten really, really rigid by virtue of the distance now that exists between representatives and their constituents.
Do you see that helping with the social media issue you were talking about? Because, you know, if someone's here in Wisconsin, and they, you know, they may not love their local representative, but they find somebody on the extreme of their side in Minnesota or Georgia or California or you name it. They throw money over there. They support maybe the most extreme versions of their personal politics. Does having more and closer representation help overcome that?
So I think it's a part of what we need. And the truth is, the reason I'm working on a series of columns over the whole year for the Washington Post is because I do think we need more than one thing. Mm-hmm. So I think the renovation job is big enough that, you know, you can't just fix the front door, just fix the porch. We really have to pay attention to a few different things that we need. And you've pointed to a really big issue, namely the way our elections currently work. Most elections are at this point decided in primaries, where a sliver of the activist party base is really making the decision for the electorate. So we also really need to look at how we run elections in our states to see if we can deliver a system that pulls the whole electorate in all the way through the process. So if you could do that second thing alongside a bigger Congress, then I think we start to get back to having that kind of representation that's actually responsive to the people generally.
Yeah, one of your pieces you mentioned on multiple members and ranked choice voting as options.
Exactly, yes. So, and you know, there are lots of different pieces to think about. And in some sense, it's a question of like, what do you do when at sort of which point in time? And I actually think the most important thing to do first is to think about really opening up the primary system. So to, for example, follow the examples of Louisiana, California, Arizona, and Nevada, and dispense with state-run party primaries, instead have all-comer preliminaries. And then, you know, in those all-comer preliminaries, you've got Democrats running and Republicans and maybe some Greens or some independents. Then you take on a batch of finalists. Mm. I would recommend, you know, five finalists. And then you take the general election, those five finalists, and you use instant runoff in the general so that whoever wins has to get a full majority, over 50%, before they can lift up the winner's crown. So that is a kind of mechanism that would do a lot to take the polarization out of our politics and give elected officials the right kinds of incentives. They would know that at every stage of that process, they are accountable to the whole electorate. That gives them more space to be independent in their actions and choices in Congress, and keeps things focused on, you know, trying to find a big, broad majoritarian synthesis of what we want to do.
Let's bring on a caller. Ron is with us in Wautoma. Ron, hi.
Hi. I think that you should take the money out of Washington. I think that would be a big benefit. Make it a volunteer position and no lobbying. I think that would help, because the people that are going to get elected are the people that are trying to get money and all the good stuff that comes along with being elected.
Ron, thanks for the call. Danielle, what do you think?
Well, it's 100% the case that we need a service ethos in our House of Representatives and across all of our elected officials. So I'm with you, was it Ron, in terms of needing a service ethos? I do think tackling campaign finance issues is an important part of getting to that. That said, I do support salaries for elected officials. We want to make sure that service is truly open to everybody and that you don't have to be in a position to pay your own salary for a full year in order to serve. So I do think it's important that elected officials be salaried.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute or so, Danielle, another point, and I think you'll be writing about this over the course of the year, boosting our civic infrastructure. Can you tease us as to what that might look like?
Oh, gosh. Thank you so much. Well, I mean, you are an example of our civic infrastructure, right? Here you are. You're covering issues locally. You're connecting local to national. But so much of the country at this point lives in news deserts where people don't have access to really basic information about what's happening in local politics. And if you look around the country, when you look at how our elections operate, often, for example, there's a requirement for public notice that things be posted in local newspapers so that the community is aware that they're happening. That whole sort of apparatus of public notice, it doesn't really function well anymore because of the decimation of local newspapers. And you can go down the line and, you know, the ways we used to have civic gathering spaces, we don't really have anymore. So we actually have to give some thought to how to rebuild those components of information sharing, space and public gathering and the like that actually support people's ability to see and shape what's happening in their own communities. So that's really what civic infrastructure is about. And I think there are a lot of folks all around the country who are trying to figure out how to get us to a place where we can reinvest in the civic infrastructure that supports healthy participation.
Danielle, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for your time.
That's Danielle Allen, professor of political philosophy, ethics, and public policy at Harvard University. She has a regular column at the Washington Post. She joined us for a look at the divides in American politics and some ways to bridge those divides. Wisconsin Supreme Court elections were once obscure, low turnout affairs. Otherwise, reliable voters often stayed home. Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz is doing everything she can to prevent that this year. And she's getting a big assist from the Democratic Party. As Sean Johnson reports, Protasiewicz has been open about her personal beliefs on issues that could come before the court.
On a Saturday night in March, people lined up down the block outside the Barrymore Theater on Madison's East Side. The featured act that night, a live recording of the national show Pod Save America, was in town to bring attention to Wisconsin's Supreme Court race. At the front of the line is Madison resident Ariel Hendrickson, who says the election boils down to two issues.
Abortion rights and making sure that gerrymandering does not get any worse in our state.
Person after person says the same thing. And Sheila Hosseini of Madison says people understand the stakes of the race, which could flip the court from a conservative to a liberal majority for the first time in 15 years.
Probably. I mean, I know people keep saying this, but this is probably one of the most important elections for Wisconsin, especially because reproductive rights are on the line.
Protasiewicz says she decided to run for the court precisely because it's so important. Prior to being a judge, she spent decades as a Milwaukee County prosecutor. Whoever wins Wisconsin's Supreme Court race will likely hear a challenge to the state's pre-Civil War abortion ban. Protasiewicz is facing former state Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly. He's backed by Republicans and endorsed by the state's three anti-abortion groups.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Judge Janet Protasiewicz.
During a brief interview in front of a packed theater at the Pod Save America recording, Protasiewicz is asked what kind of difference she could make on abortion rights if she wins.
So I'll tell you this. I have been very, very forthright that my personal value is that women have a right to choose.
She's also asked about Wisconsin's Republican-drawn legislative districts. Protasiewicz calls the maps rigged. And she adds,
I would certainly welcome the opportunity to have a fresh look at our maps.
The Democratic voters in this auditorium know her message, possibly because they've had a chance to hear it everywhere. Protasiewicz has shattered campaign fundraising records thanks to millions of dollars in transfers from the state Democratic Party. That same night, party chair Ben Wickler frames the stakes in presidential terms. He asks Democrats to imagine it's election night in 2024. The eyes of the nation are on swing state Wisconsin. A lawsuit is filed, and the court's conservative majority stops the count.
And record scratch, freeze frame, you think to yourself, in 2023, I had a chance to stop this guy from getting on the Supreme Court and casting that deciding vote.
There are those who think the level of political drama playing out in Wisconsin's Supreme Court race is inappropriate. Former Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Gieske was appointed to the court in 1993 and won election in 1994. She thinks court races have gotten too political and says both sides are to blame.
You know, historically, when we ran, and I ran a long time ago, we wouldn't go anywhere near talking about an issue that might come before the court.
Kelly has been far more guarded about sharing his personal views. He argues Protasiewicz crossed a line by sharing hers. Supreme Court races are still technically nonpartisan, but people who show up to see Protasiewicz in Madison are okay with the way she talks about the race. Carol Drysdale says it's a nice idea that a justice could be completely objective.
That someone can leave behind everything that they are and everything that they have experienced and lived through and just leave it all at the door and be completely objective. But that's not how human beings work.
Drysdale says there's more at stake in this race than just purely judicial matters. She says she knows where Protasiewicz stands on issues like abortion rights and says that's why she's voting for her. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can also read Sean Johnson's profile of former Justice Dan Kelly, the other candidate in this race, at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, what does civic engagement mean in Wisconsin? A major report tackles that question, including a series of surveys. We'll check out the findings, and you can join in with your thoughts as well. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A Wisconsin chef joins the show to share recipes and advice from a new Italian cookbook. You can let us know your favorite Italian food right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.